House Committee on Revenue for May 5th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to do a little jumping around today as we get members in, and we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 3541. Chris, do you want to give us a sense of this bill, and then we'll hear from the two representatives.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3541 pertains to child and dependent care tax credits. It creates a pilot program that would modify how certain taxpayers would receive those dependent care credits. The eligible taxpayers are those who also receive benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. And the tax credits would be received as direct payments from the Department of Human Services during the tax year, as opposed to just being claimed on the tax return, although there would be a reconciliation on the tax return when that is filed. The program would be effective for tax years 2015 through 2020 and relative to disbursements made between January 1, 2016 and December 31st, 2021.
All right, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm Senator Hayden, State Representative from House District 7, Chair and members of the committee. The intent behind this bill, just to give you a little background, I serve on several committees as Vice Chair of House Health Committee and also Human Services and Housing. What's come out of the want to create better child care for Oregonians on several bills, I have a question. How can we make it a little more amenable to the clients that receive a child care credit so that they can even out those payments and get better child care in the month that they're using the child care? Currently, the system, they get a child care credit. They pay taxes through their employer, tax deduction through their payroll, and the state holds that child care credit. And then when they go to get their refund, they can get that in a lump sum payment. My concern with lump sum payments is we are all barraged with a lot of advertising, you know, go get your furniture, go get your boat, go get your jet skis. And so there is a lot of push for these clients to use that money for other than the intended purpose, which was for child care. What House Bill 3541 would do is it would take eligible clients that had successfully claimed this child care credit from the year before and divide that, and we're being a little rough here, divide that by 12 equal payments and then allow them to receive that payment once they were pre-qualified from last year's tax filing. To get that tax credit amount, 1/12 of that tax credit amount monthly. In order to reduce cost and to make this efficient, what we've recommended here is a pilot program that would go on the Oregon Trail card or the SNAP card. They currently have cash benefit eligibility to put on that card. There is not a requirement for them to have any, which is a food stamp benefit. They don't have a requirement to have any food stamp benefit for them to utilize that card. So even clients that no longer were qualified for SNAP could continue to use that mechanism. That is a cost-effective mechanism because it's already in place and there wouldn't be a lot of setup costs for them to do that. This is fundamentally shifting the way that we provide this tax care credit to these clients. It does not increase the amount of tax credit. It does not take away from the amount of tax credit, but it significantly makes it more efficient by 10 to 15% because a large amount of these clients use a rapid refund process at April 15th, and they pay between 10 and 15% of the tax credit that they're going to receive in that process, which decreases that amount. So even though there would be a small cost, the EBT cost to using the SNAP card, it is much, much less than what they have to pay now to get that money back. It also evens those payments out that they would receive otherwise on a monthly basis, so they actually have the cash flow in order to pay that child care in the month that they use that child care. Now, you could argue this is coming retroactively from last year. It's not actually coming from last year. The Department of Revenue and the Department of Human Service and LC and I have worked together to make sure that that tax credit is still considered a tax credit because there was concern that they would be it would be taxable funds if they received it monthly. We believe we have figured that and provided a solution in this bill so that they're not taxed on that, even though they receive it monthly. It's like a loan or a draw on that tax credit. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill. We've got possibly some talking points here. It has very bipartisan support if you look at the sponsors of the bill. The reason it's a pilot project, and I was urged to expand it immediately, I wanted to keep it at a pilot project level so that we can work out any wrinkles that could come up in the future with this, but it could significantly be expanded and kind of become the way that we treat some of these tax credits so Oregonians can get the money that they've earned back into their pocket in an efficient manner so they increase the quality and consistency of their daycare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I'm simply here to support Representative Hayden and applaud his good work on this topic. I find it particularly appropriate that it has to do with child care. This week, I am even more aware of the importance of that than some other weeks. My wife and our daughter are away, and so every day I'm thinking more about child care than a lot of other weeks. I think this particular approach is really appropriate, and it speaks to the larger issue of how not only can we be efficient, which, and I agree with Representative Hayden's point on that, but also effective when tax credits come in a large sum payment once a year. It makes it that much harder for those who are receiving it to integrate that income throughout the course of their year, not only to deal with the potential of larger purchases, but just in the day-to-day, month-to-month activities of life. We've had really interesting discussions in this committee and elsewhere about some of the objections and criticisms of other similar tax credits and approaches like the Earned Income Tax Credit, and I think this approach offers a lot of potential to test whether it's feasible. I believe, and I think Representative Hayden believes, that this would be a good outcome, but we have to get it right and make sure that it works before we expand it. It'd be my hope that we can pass this, perfect the mechanics of it, and then be able to expand it to a larger number of similar programs so that, as Representative Hayden said, people can more effectively use the dollars that we have decided to invest. So I think I want to just conclude again by applauding Representative Hayden and a number of the other people who have worked so hard on this. I hope we can pass it along. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Questions? Yes, Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to check in about, because these would be, so in the project, first of all, thank you both for being here and talking about this. As you may have heard in other situations, I occasionally carpool with Rep. Kenny Geyer, so I hear bits and pieces about some of the many interesting things you guys have done in the Human Services Committee. And so I had kind of heard bits and pieces about this. The part I had not been aware of was the correlation to the SNAP benefits. It makes a lot of sense to me from you already have that relationship. It makes it a kind of a more closed loop. My question is, would that part of their tax credit that they are receiving, could they only use it the same, like, as a SNAP benefit, so on only food products, or is the card just the mechanism and you could use the money any way that you care to?
Thank you for the question, Representative Smith-Warner. The answer is no, it would not have to be used as a SNAP benefit. The food stamps, Oregon Trail Card, and SNAP are terms all for the same thing. And what that is a federally funded program that provides basically a plastic card, and it gets reloaded with a benefit for them to go buy certain food items. In addition to that, we use that for a cash benefit, like for school lunches and things like that. So our state of Oregon uses the federal SNAP or Oregon Trail Card system to add a cash benefit to it. This would use that existing system to add to that cash benefit. There is not a requirement by the feds that says if a person loses or is no longer eligible for SNAP benefit that we have to take that card away. That is why we have chosen to use this vehicle, because they can have an Oregon Trail card with a zero food stamp benefit and still use it for a cash benefit for child care in this instances.
So, if I may follow up.
Yeah.
So the cash benefit that would be on it, would that be a cash benefit or a cash benefit that could be used towards child care?
So it would be a cash benefit with the purpose of using it for child care, but just like the tax credit, we've gone to great lengths not to change what the tax credit is. Now they receive it at a 12-month lump sum, and they are free to use that for whatever they want. It's a reimbursement for their child care, but they don't have to spend it directly on next year's child care, and as you can imagine, it probably doesn't get saved for 12 months to do it. What this bill would do would provide 12-month increments of that, smaller increments, so there's a cash flow advantage of it. There's a built-in savings of it. The state of Oregon would not hold those funds for 12 to 18 months, waiting them for file that refund. They would not lose a 10 to 15% when they went to do that rapid refund to get the money quickly. And so the intent is for them to use it for better child care, but they would not be restricted on what that cash benefit was used for. Just like they're not now.
Final follow-up. Mm-hmm. So to just confirm then, the Oregon Trail card, the cash benefit that would be on that, that would be put onto that card, is it like a debit card or that it would, does it have that same function?
That is correct.
That element. Great.
Thank you, Representative Smith-Warner. It is like a debit card. If you want to get more into it, the TANF system is the cash benefit that they get for different allowances, and they use that process, and they can go to certain ATMs and point of sale, get cash out on it.
Great. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
So I have a comment regarding the EBT cards, which is what we're talking about here, these benefit cards. And Representative Olson and I tried to get photos on the cards unsuccessfully to identify the cardholder. Tried to get names on the cards. Don't know if that's going to work or not. How much is it going to cost to do what you're talking about? The bankers are telling us it's just too expensive to identify the cards by a name on the outside of it or a photo on the outside of it. So what's this going to cost to do this extra service that you're talking about, distributed over a monthly, 12 times a year?
Thank you, Representative. I have done quite a bit of research on that as far as securing the card. I do feel that having a cash benefit, what happens in some instances is when the cash benefit runs out for a client, sometimes, I don't believe it's a lot of cases, but those cases do hit the media, sometimes a person sells or that card is stolen because there's still a SNAP benefit, but the TANF benefit or the cash benefit has been expired. And so what this system would do, they don't normally get a new card every month. They continue to get that card, and that SNAP benefit gets reloaded onto that credit card or that Oregon Trail card. So if they know monthly that benefit through the child care is now coming, they're going to be a little more diligent to keep that card rather than to have it get lost. There is a bill working through, and there is some support because of the financial impact. If a card has to be replaced, then that replacement card would have a name on it. The federal government does not explicitly say you can't have a photo ID on it. There are hoops that you could walk through to do that, but in researching that, it seems far too expensive, and looking at some of the states that have tried to do that, it doesn't seem to cut their abuse at all. And so that is a separate issue of this, but it is possible, and I think possibly to get a name on the card for replacement purposes.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate this innovative idea, and it's useful to look at. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 3541? Yes, please.
Thank you, members, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. We worked with Representative Kenny Geyer on the discussion that she had about combining tax credits, and Representative Hayden brought up on a couple of instances this idea that he's had, and I see it has had a fair amount of work involved with it. From an advocacy point of view, we really like the idea about people having the dollars that could be available to them on a monthly basis, because child care doesn't happen at the end of the year when you would get a lump sum. Having said that, I just really don't know. I don't see anybody from the department here. I don't know if all of the issues have been worked out with the department. And if not, or if there are some obstacles, I would certainly be interested to work on coming up with a solution for this, because I think the intention and the bipartisan nature of this discussion is a good one about making sure that people have the resources they need to pay the bills as they come up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today? I want to get on to other business as soon as we can, but I also don't want to close the hearing until we're ready. Please.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm representing AFSCME. We represent licensed in-home child care providers. Very supportive of the idea. I would just like to be part of any discussions about how that would work for payments with child care providers, because I'm not sure that all of them take debit or credit cards. And so if there are any further discussions, and I would like just to flag that as a possible concern.
Right. And I think Representative Hayden wants to comment on that question.
So I'm sorry to jump
in. And actually, that's a very good question. Please.
So you might have to repeat the question of Senator Caden again, State Representative. So there was a question, does the department have any concerns? I have gone to the Department of Human Services and asked them for initial review of it, although they don't weigh in pro or con on bills. They have provided me with that. It is on your OLIS. It is posted on OLIS, their questions, and my response to those questions, I don't see any of those concerns as something that we can't overcome. They may not even require an amendment to the bill, because the bill allows for that collaboration, but we're certainly willing to work on any issues that we need to iron out with that.
And you might be able to answer the other implied question, which really was, child care providers often don't have a card reader or a way of taking money off of a card. How is there a way for people who would be reimbursed on the card to use those funds to pay the child care person, if you know?
I do not know the answer to that, but it's something I could research.
Something to explore. All right. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony, and thank you for sticking around.
Thank you.
So you can answer those questions. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3541 and open a work session on House Bill 2083. Chris, is that yours?
No.
No? Oh, that's right. Kyle, yes. And then my plan is to move to the issue of House Bill 3086 while I have a significant percentage of the members of the committee here before they run off to other assignments.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2083, with the Dash 2 amendments, this was a bill that's making changes to the senior and disabled deferral account. We do have all the paperwork in. We heard the bill earlier, but we didn't have the paperwork ready at that time. But we do have the paperwork in, and I can go through the changes in the revenue impact statement if you'd like, briefly. But so House Bill 2382 with the Dash 2 amendments would make, primarily it's going to make four changes to the senior and disabled deferral account, three of which will have some impact upon the change in the senior and the revolving account. So as you can see, in the Dash 2, the expectation is there would be a slight decrease in the revolving account, and this is a reflection of the changes in the bill that would increase participation initially in the program. And then, so initially there's going to be more payments going out of the program, and then over time repayments will be coming in as these individuals that would otherwise not be in the program are in, and they make the repayments further down the road. But the three changes, there's the change in the five-year ownership requirement, an increase in the RMV limits for participants that are in their home for 21 or more years, and then there's also a change that would require a recertification outreach. So the Department of Revenue will work with I believe it's the Senior and Peoples with DHS Senior SPD program to reach out to individuals who are up for recertification in the deferral account for those that haven't initially responded to the letter mailed out by Department of Revenue. So it's expected that a few more people will stay in the program due to this outreach as well.
Right. Thank you. Any questions about this? It's been a while since we've looked at it. Representative Vance, please.
I just was wondering that the what was the fiscal on it? Is there a fiscal on it? Given the fact that there's a thought that for a while our expenditures go up.
It's minimal.
I believe it was a minimal. I'm just double checking.
I'm looking too.
It is. Yeah.
It is minimal.
It's okay. Minimal.
Yeah, it was
minimal. Minimal fiscal.
Thank you.
And yes, that just a note on that, I guess, Representative Vance, there was some discussion the Department of Revenue would be purchasing insurance, but it is, there's no requirement the Department of Revenue would have to purchase insurance for property, so they expect to use that very little. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Vance, are you ready to?
Ready to move. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to HB 2083.
Representative Vance moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2083. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2083 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves House Bill 2083 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it is adopted, and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Who would like to carry? Representative Vega Peterson? Representative Vega Peterson will carry. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2083 and open a work session on House Bill 3086. And I think we have a couple of members who want to be heard on that one, don't we?
Kenner had to leave.
Oh, we had to leave. Oh, okay. Well, I'm very glad to have you here because it's a kind of complicated situation we're facing. Do you want to give us a review of where we are, and then we'll hear from the good representative?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3086, you have in OLIS a dash one amendment. The amendment replaces the bill, and it requires the city of Damascus to post notices in at least two public locations that the city is required to satisfy all current and pending debts and obligations, and that anyone who believes themselves to be creditors of the city should present claims for payment. And then from there, it directs Damascus to pay outstanding debts and obligations for city employee benefits. It requires funds from the city road fund to be transferred to Clackamas County for road maintenance, and this would be only within the former city boundaries. It requires an amount not to exceed $3 million to be transferred to the Clackamas County to pay expenses related to the transfer of employees to the county, contracted law enforcement services, and other current service expenses in the budget of Damascus. It requires that the money left over after meeting these obligations be transferred to the taxpayers in proportion to the property tax they pay for tax years beginning July 1st, 2014 and ending June 30th, 2017. And also, it requires funds that would have been distributed to the city of Damascus for cigarette taxes, highway fund appropriations, emergency communications, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission account to go to the Clackamas County to defer costs related to the distribution of funds back to property taxpayers. So the measure is found to have no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact is described in the fiscal impact statement. It's estimated that the balance remaining to be returned back to Damascus taxpayers would be $4.0 million.
Okay. Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51, coming before you with a dash one amendment. Thank you very much. The last time I was here, you guys, this is a very complicated and really kind of it is a unique situation. This is something that has not been done before, not only because there hasn't been a city to disincorporate in many, many, many years, but also this unique situation of the city having so much excess property tax money that really rightfully, much of it belongs to go back to the people. They paid property taxes in order to have a functioning city, and because of strange constraints by the city charter, they didn't get that functioning city, but their money was still taken. So I appreciate you working with us. I want to highlight just a few of the issues that most of you brought up, but particularly Representative Benz, had some very just good questions about the initial piece of legislation. So initially, on page one, there is now a notice posting requirement. So as soon as the city would be disincorporated under a measure that's now over on the Senate side, there would be a requirement for the city to post a notice to let people who believe that they are creditors of the city to come forward. So there's that posting requirement. Again, this is a small city, so this is not it's not a vast area. So that's one thing that had been a concern in the initial hearing. So that's taken care of. On page 2, line 25, that once the city is disincorporated after those 60 days, that money is actually now transferred to Clackamas County, who will be the body that will distribute the excess funds to the property taxpayers. Representative Benz made the point that we were asking the city of Damascus to do it, but the city of Damascus wouldn't be in existence anymore after 60 days. So thank you for that keen observation, and that is now addressed. On page 3, this was also a point brought up by the Vice Chair Benz. On line 1, the date that the checks will go out, the excess money to the property taxpayers will not go out till June 30th of 2018, which is significant because that would satisfy the statute of limitations for any tort claims against the city, so that there's not any that obligation would not be shifting itself onto Clackamas County. So those are the highlights as addressed in the hearing that we had before you before. So I would certainly love the opportunity to move this over to the Senate side. I will tell you that we are still in ongoing negotiations. We, as in Representative Kennemer, who is not able to stick around today, but he and I are still working on this together and would certainly love the opportunity to co-carry it if it pleases the chair. And we are still in negotiations with Clackamas County. It's been there's been no contention so far. It's really not even it's mostly just a matter of getting the language right and making sure that we capture all the obligations that would go to the county and make sure those are accounted for here. So we are still working, but we're anxious to get this bill over to the Senate side because two of the other bills that kind of are a Damascus package are over there and have been over there for almost a month now. So we're anxious to get this bill over to the Senate side where we can further refine it with our work with Clackamas County. I didn't know if Chris Lyon, I saw him here, if he wanted to say anything, but he's certainly been in negotiations with the county to make sure that just again, because it's such a technical bill that this works out over there. So we'd certainly love the opportunity to get over to the Senate so that we can do further work on it.
Right. As it stands, you think this amendment does the job. But we do have another chance on the Senate if that's not quite true.
That it's not quite true in the sense that there's a much more complicated issue that we're thinking about dealing with. We're considering, and I haven't even talked to my constituents about this, which is why I'm not anxious to, we're considering actually moving the election date. But to move the election date, we have to move that in a bill that's over on the Senate side. There is a complication that comes up with the fact that we'd be having the election in November, and the city would not be disincorporated until January, and so the tax year would have already opened. And that didn't sound that complicated at first, but Clackamas County made it clear that it's not as easy as just refunding taxes because not all of people's property taxes goes to the county. And then with compression issues, the formula actually moves depending on how much money actually is given by the city. So it's actually quite complicated. So they're discussing with us whether we should actually change the election date to May of 2014 so that the tax year never opens. 2016. So that is a negotiation that is ongoing. So I don't think it'd be fair to say that this is the end all be all. The problem is that if we were to make that change, the bill we need to make that change on is over in the Senate. So we don't want to amend this until we've amended that, but we don't want to start those bills until this one gets over there. So this is kind of like I was the youngest of three kids. This is like the little sister being left behind. It's like, wait for me. And so those two bills are over there and they're ready to, we're just kind of want to hold off on them until all three of them are together so we can present them as a package. Because as you can see, it's kind of complicated to talk about this issue in isolation when there's two other companion bills that go along with this.
Right. And hopefully they'll all end up in the same committee.
Yes, that is certainly the hope. We were talking to the Senate president about that.
Right.
Because they're in Senate rules, so they can kind of anything can go there.
Right. Okay. Any questions on this? I will note that changing the election date isn't going to have any effect on, or very little effect on this bill, because this bill only goes into effect after the measure is approved by the voters.
True.
Yeah, I think you might be okay on this bill, even if you move the election day.
Potentially.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for those kind remarks, but I don't know if they're that kind, because I'm just wondering who gets blamed when none of this works. I think it was really Representative Davis that made
it. Only if it doesn't go well.
Right.
And I was going to take credit until that remark, and I think it must have been Representative Davis as well.
Right. Actually, I did have a question.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. So that is the question. Who is it? Is it the county, then, that bears the responsibility of anything that goes haywire in this effort? And that's why, when in our previous discussions here in the offline, the question was, what was that fund? And now I see $3 million that is there in case something turns up. Is that what is going to absorb things that we haven't foreseen?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Benz, that $3 million fund is not, I wouldn't say that it's so much there only as insurance. It's actually there for, there are certain things that the county will definitely expend monies on for that $3 million. The risk, I guess, that something will go haywire is I think significantly mitigated by the changes that we're making, which the county has initiated all of those changes. I wouldn't say that there's a fund that's there in case. I mean, that's why the Tort Claims Act will have run, so we'll know about any claims before any checks go out. So certainly, if there is a tort claim, those funds would not be considered excess, so they would never actually, some of them would never go back to. So there's kind of three different pots of money. One is the road fund money. Again, that just wouldn't make sense. You can't figure out how to give gas tax money back. The other one is the $3 million that is up to $3 million that's for the county to use to pay employees to do some of the things that the county is going to have to do if the city disincorporates. And the third pot is the pot that, in theory, all of that pot will go back to property tax owners. But we have the notice of creditors posting required right away. We have the Tort Claims Act running so that once that fund is distributed, the risk is very mitigated that there will be any issues because it won't be distributed until kind of those statute of limitations have run on potential claims.
Yeah, please.
Okay, all that's fine, but who is it that if there is a claim and there isn't money there, who gets sued? Do they just say, too bad, there's nothing there, the city is gone? It's not the stuff that I know that we know about, it's the stuff that we don't.
Mr. Chair, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, I understand. I think the legal answer would just be if somebody sues, if this plays it out, you would just say, well, the statute of limitations has run on your claim. Like, nobody's liable because that's why we have that date far out so that we would know before the funds even go out if there is any tort claims.
Contract claims. Contract claims are 6 years, aren't they, for...
Correct. We've been looking at the contracts, and there's certainly no new contracts starting right now. I think the one that we're aware of is the sheriff's contract. That's already covered in the $3 million that they're getting, that they can pay that out. So the contracts that they're currently in, we're trying to cover those amounts. The city would stop being in existence after 60 days. So on a technical legal point, that's an interesting, just a legal question in terms of the city doesn't exist anymore, so whether there would be a contract claim if the city doesn't exist after 60 days, as opposed to a tort claim against a public body.
I just wonder if this is the vehicle to address these kinds of issues, you might want to put something in it that says, and that's all she wrote, folks.
that's a great idea, yeah.
Can I use that exact language, Mr. Vice Chair? I'm sure LC will have no problem with that.
You guys said that. I got it from Representative Davis, so don't give
Okay. Other questions? Are we ready to move this one out and accomplish the wish that the Representative Fagan has to get it over to the Senate so they can deal with all three of these bills? Representative Benz?
Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3086.
Representative Benz moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 3086. Is there any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 3086 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 3086 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Fagan will carry, and Representative Kenemer will the two of them will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3086 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2239. Chris, and then Representative Davis.
My windows are closed. Give me a second here.
That's what you get when you have a common computer.
Yes, it's a risk. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2239 creates an employer tax credit for hiring at-risk or disadvantaged youth or those with developmental disabilities. The bill defines terms, and qualifying youths are between the ages of 16 and 18 and work at least 200 hours during the tax year. The bill also disallows the deduction for wages in the amount equal to the tax credit taken to avoid a double-dipping situation, and applies to tax years 2015 through 2020.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here on this side and to discuss with you House Bill 2239, which comes to you unanimously from the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. It's also co-sponsored by Representative Fagan, who is just here, and Representative Clem. The point of this bill, and really the purpose, is to try to develop a very targeted tax credit to encourage hiring of what is now being called or who are now being called opportunity youth. And the bill defines as at-risk, disadvantaged, or youth with an intellectual or developmental disability. And the focus has narrowed considerably since the bill was first introduced. I want to thank Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer for working with me extensively on the bill, as well as Chris Allenack on his great work to try to make a workable bill that has a very has a modest, if not small, revenue impact, and we'll get some initial numbers in a few minutes. But before we get into that, the problem that this seeks to address is, A, the lack of youth employment in general, but focusing in particular on at-risk, disadvantaged, and disabled youth. The last decade has been described by some as the lost decade when it comes to youth employment. According to Opportunity Nation, as of 2013, this data came out. In 2000, 45% of teens were employed. By 2011, just 26% of teens were employed. And if you add to it the layer of being an at-risk, disadvantaged, or disabled youth, those numbers go down even further. More generally, some of the employment facts from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for all intellectually and developmentally disabled Americans stated that in February 2014, only 19% of that population was employed. Again, add to that the layer of being youth, and I think the data is would be much less. It's sort of hard to pin down exactly how low the number is, but I would say it's definitely lower than the 26% of youth in general and the 19% of generally those who are intellectually and developmentally disabled. So we're talking about a population who we know if they can get work experience as 16, 17-year-olds, it will both help them personally and individually in their development. It will help the public in the reduced use of taxpayer resources and in the contribution to society that these youth and now adults will be able to contribute. So with that problem being stated, this is a modest proposal for a potential step in the right direction to add an incentive for employers to hire at-risk developmentally disabled or intellectually disabled youth on their employment roles. And here's how this would work. It would be a 25% tax credit for the employer for hiring one of these youth who qualifies. The qualifying factors for being at risk or disadvantaged under the bill are a student eligible for free or reduced lunch, an individual taking part in an IEP plan, an individual not enrolled in school or currently participating in the labor force, a student who's currently in foster care, a youth offender, or a youth who's currently in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. The reason that we have these definitions, which change significantly from the original bill, is that these are already certified, defined populations by the state. So it doesn't require an agency or DOR or any other state actor to go again and recertify who might qualify for this program. To be completely honest, after seeing some of the numbers that Chris Allenack pulled, I'm a little concerned that including all kids on free or reduced lunch might be too large of a population. Chris, maybe you can jump in and say what that number was. I think 55,000, 58,000?
58,000.
58,000. So a pretty large contingent where I'm really trying to focus on a much more defined group. So that is a piece of the bill that could use some work. In addition, we, and this was at the suggestion of Chair Kenny Geyer, to not simply have this opened up for any employer who might employ a kid for, you know, a few hours, putting some minimal requirements or legislative sideboards around what sort of employment would be required. In this case, the employer would have to employ the student for at least 200 hours during the tax year, which is essentially a summer job. It's either a part-time job each week or it's a medium to full-time summer job would be required. So there would actually have to be a significant investment in the youth. And then I wanted to make absolutely clear that this tax credit could not be taken in addition to the typical business deduction that's taken for all employee wages. So the bill makes that clear in the engrossed version. So you could take out of 100% of wages paid, of course, all employers would get the 75% of those wages deducted from their business income tax from their calculation of income. And then this would add a layer of 25% of a tax credit as well for that employer. So the bill makes absolutely clear that this would not be a tax credit in addition to the deduction that's already taken. It is also not refundable. So again, adding sideboards so that this credit couldn't be abused. So that's sort of the general scope. This tax credit looks a little bit like the federal work opportunity tax credit. It looks a little bit like the New York Youth Work Tax Credit, looks a little bit like the Utah Targeted Jobs Tax Credit, the Maryland Disabled Employment Tax Credit. Colorado has a similar tax credit, New Jersey, Virginia. All of them work a little bit differently, so this is a proposal for something that might work for Oregon employers. With that, I'd be happy to take any technical questions related to the bill, and we do have some advocates here to speak in support, I believe. And who knows, maybe some people in opposition, but they haven't told me yet.
Questions? Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benz blocks our sight lines.
He does that to me all the time.
You're getting picked on today, aren't you?
Sorry, Rep. Boone. thank you. This is what an interesting idea. I just wanted to say, it must have been interesting to work on. Lots of advocates, I'm sure. So the thing that popped into my head about it is when you started talking about sideboards to make sure it doesn't get taken advantage of, is I thought, well, what about like and in no way pejorative, but like a Goodwill Industries that's already going to a big part of what they do is employing, you know, a lot of these populations to begin with, and they're a nonprofit in the first place. So I guess would this apply to them as well, to kind of anybody?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. No, in that instance of the example of Goodwill, this isn't a transferable tax credit. So they, as a nonprofit, Goodwill would not be able to utilize this because they currently don't pay any income tax to begin with. And it's not transferable. Some nonprofits can take tax credits and sell them. This would not be one of those. So it would not be a benefit for nonprofits who are already doing this. This would be for private companies.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. So what's it?
I was wondering what sort of jobs would we be looking at? Would they be looking at primarily summer, you said, I assume. outdoors? What do you have in mind?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, the bill does not specify the type of job, although I do think the sideboard of 200 hours minimum requirement really does speak to the summer job opportunity or the part-time work all year. But beyond that, there's no restriction on the type of work, and I think you'll hear some of the advocates speak about really these youth can do a whole lot. That's why we call them up. There's great opportunities there. That's why we call them opportunity youth. And Chair Barnett, if I could, I forgot to ask Chris to discuss that. I know it's a preliminary number, but he's done a lot of work on crunching the numbers on what the revenue impact would be.
Sure. Everything still is working through, and right now the annual revenue impact when kind of fully phased in is about $4 million a year. The bill applies to, in 2015, it's a partial year. It applies to employees who would be first hired after either June 1st or July 1st. So there's a partial year there, so that's about $1 million. And then about a $3 million year impact in 2016, up to $4 million. With other tax credits that have been created, we've seen kind of this phase-in period. While there is not a statutory phase-in, there's a practical one.
Yeah.
You know, by the time the bill comes into effect, we'll see what happens in 2015, how quickly people respond to the advocates. I'm sure we'll get the word out. And then 2016, so I kind of have a ramping up. Ramping up is probably a better phrase than phase-in because that's kind of a technical term. So it ramps up, and about a $4 million impact when we get to a fully implemented program. A big chunk of it, and the biggest potential wild card, is the free and reduced lunch program. That is about 58,000 is the number I have in there now. For the total potential participants, it's about 85,000 for the different groups. Mm-hmm. And so 70% of the impact, as I have it laid out right now, is due to that one category. So that is a potential for further.
Yeah. And Chair Barnhart, thank you very much, Chris. And just in my mind, I've been aiming for kind of a $2 million annual number. That was just pulled out of nowhere. It sounded small enough to be reasonable and not get laughed off the dais. And so we're down from, I think we started at 12, adding the sideboards we've already added, gets it down to about 4. I think additional discussions on the and reductions of the free and reduced lunch could potentially get us down to that $2 million mark that I've been thinking of.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Well, thanks for developing this bill. I think it's a really interesting idea and important also. I have a question actually for Mr. Alanak. So does the $4 million a year fully implemented impact, does that assume that all 85,000 of the young people are utilized or a subset? And if so, how did you get to the subset? Because it seems like potentially the exposure is all 85,000 of the young people are employed, and you know, on some level that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
But what would that cost?
It Rep. Leininger, it is, there are two assumptions, starting with that number, that 85,000 or so is the population. And then the approach I'm taking so far is kind of two steps from that. The first would be what share of those would be actively looking for work. And I have that right now at about 35%, which is based on other population statistics for other youths who are employed. So I take the population of youths age 16 to 18 and how many of them are employed, and that's about a third. Or looking for either employed or looking for work. Mm. So that's about a third. And then from that, so we have the pool, and then it's how many are actually employed, kind of an employment percentage of those who are looking for work. And I have that at 20% right now.
Of the 35%?
Of the 35%. So it's kind of a two-step process. You have, and the first question has been trying to identify the population, and then how many of them would be looking for work, and then how many of them could get work.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I have a further question. And I really like the idea of this. I was just wondering if this could have any effect on individuals, if they work as much, then being eligible for the earned income tax refund for low-income people, those that are 18 years old. I assume you're not eligible until you are an adult at 18, and it says 19, so for that group of people that is falls under the 19, but, mm-hmm. you know, older than 18. Or a reduction of other benefits.
Chair Barnett, yeah. Representative Woods, it's a good question, but recall that this credit focuses on the employer side. So it doesn't actually, it's not a credit on the employee side. The employee is not receiving additional benefit except for, you know, the job, which could, of course, reduce public benefits. But the actual operation of the credit itself does not reduce benefits. And if I could make a final comment as well, I think this is an interesting area to ask, okay, we could either do nothing, we could do a direct wage subsidy in a programmatic way, through a state, you know, employment department, pick your department, or we could do a tax credit, which here looks kind of a lot like a direct expenditure program. So there's three sort of broad options. I would argue that, no, we could do nothing, okay. It would be relatively administratively inefficient compared to a tax credit that's focused like this to operate it as a direct subsidy program because of the layers of administrative function that would have to take place. The tax credit might reach a broader group than you may perfectly like in a perfectly administered government agency program, but I think the sort of incremental cost of that program above the cost of the tax credit can speak to how this might be an effective way to use a credit to induce behavior as opposed to a direct spending program.
Sort of a follow-up. I don't know if it's any a possibility even that this could generate revenue for the state because you have individuals working and the employers paying taxes on them working. I mean, I don't know if that's a possibility. There's two ways to look at it, and that might be a possibility there.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative, it's a very good point. I think the long-term prospect of the point would be, hey, the more folks that we can get employed and some work experience, the better chance they're going to have at a lifetime of employment, and the long-term net benefits could be positive for the state.
Yep, Representative Langer.
Thank you. So I was looking at other testimony submitted on the bill, and I noticed that someone raised the issue of the idea that it could be used against to get down to below the minimum tax for the employer. Would you potentially be open to, I think we're not scheduled, are we scheduled for a work session at the moment?
No.
So would you consider an amendment that would not enable this credit to be used against the corporate minimum tax if we were generally trending toward, you know, having everyone pay corporate minimum?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative, thank, I think it's, I read that testimony, was very interested in the concept. I think, you know, that's a concept that we're struggling with in revenue and in the tax credit committee more generally as it relates to all tax credits. So I would object to its insertion in an individual tax credit bill. I'd rather see that concept addressed more broadly if we're going to apply it to all tax credits or no tax credits rather than in a piecemeal fashion. That would be my proposal.
Sure, yes.
What's it? Would they, these young people, be able to work in agriculture? For example, when I was growing up, a big thing was go work in the onion fields pulling weeds because it's a job that you could get. And so I was just wondering, would this be something that they could do, would be to work in agriculture if they want to, like we used to 40 years ago?
Chair Barnhart, yes.
Okay.
Great idea.
Yeah, well, work for us.
Yeah, right. Good. Other questions? We have one panel to be heard in favor, and you will get your wish. There will be a couple against.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wish may be the wrong word.
Well, that may have been the wrong word. Sorry, Representative.
Expectation.
Expectation,
perhaps.
Right. Erica Brown, Ross Ryan, Anna Keenan Mudrick, please. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming today. State your name for the record and then give your testimony, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee.
I moved the mic around so that it's about 6 inches. There you
go. Okay, there we go.
That's perfect.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Erica Brown. I'm an employment clinical supervisor at Partnerships in Community Living, which is a nonprofit organization that supports people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, both residentially and through an employment services department, should they choose to pursue community employment. Prior to coming on board with PCL, I was a vocational rehabilitation counselor for the state of Oregon for 8 years. And I was primarily working with youth in transition who were considered to be at-risk youth, a variety of disabilities, including intellectual and developmental disabilities. What I know about these kids, these youth, is they are mainstreamed in their classrooms. They're being taught alongside their typically developing peers in the same career classes to set job goals that are feasible for them. And they're excited to work, and they want to contribute. And it's the challenge becomes convincing an employer that a youth with a disability can effectively work in their agency or their company. And one of the things that's difficult is there is a huge stigma attached to somebody who has a disability. It's a common belief that if an employer hires somebody with a disability that they are going to get hurt in the workplace or be difficult to employ or be a liability overall. This tax credit would allow us to approach employers in a way that speaks their language. The bottom line for an employer is business and money, and not costing them money is really enticing to them. We have, at Vocational Rehabilitation, we used a program called the On the Job Training Program. It was an incentive program where we could approach an employer and sell the idea that we would cover partial wages for a person with a disability who would come to work for them. And obviously that's not what we want the employer to be hiring somebody based on is a tax credit or a incentive, but it's often what gets their foot in the door, and that's when the myth busting can start. It allows the employer to take a leap of faith, and what we see is when the person is actually in the workplace, it has a very positive impact on work culture, and before we know it, the employer is, it's a win-win. The employer is happy that they've hired, and the impact in the workplace is positive, and there's a little bit of magic that happens when somebody with a disability comes to work each day wanting to learn and contribute, and the coworkers and their peers and their managers witness this, and it really changes the morale of the workplace. But on the fiscal side of things, the more if we don't do something to incentivize employers, all of this work and this planning that's being done behind the scenes with these youth will be for naught, because they will fall into a system that supports them, and the financial impact on our system to not have these youth plugged into the workforce will be far greater than any loss, any revenue loss that would come along with this tax credit. So thank you for your time. Thank you, Senator Davis, for your work on this. Our Senator, Representative Davis, for your work on this. And go ahead, Ross. Introduce yourself.
My name is Ross Ryan. I'm speaking on behalf of OSAC, which is an 18-member large group, and it is a statewide organization.
Okay, so
There we go.
So Ross asked me as a peer to ask him some questions in an interview style for you guys today. To be clear, I'm not paid to support Ross. I'm here as his peer. So I'll go ahead and start. Why is it important for young people with disabilities to work?
So we could be out in the community, and so people could know that we could work at any job like anybody else, and we just want to have a paycheck so we can do things.
Did you work when you were under 18?
Yeah. In California at the Armstrong Garden Center. And it was mainly the watering, the sweeping, and unloading the whiskey barrels for the plants.
What did that job teach you?
Responsibility, to be there on time, and it also taught me to be courteous to others and myself.
Did that job make you more independent?
Yes. I did things out in the community, and I also showed my parents how to ride a bus and a school teacher.
Did you know people who did not work in high school?
A few of my friends were not working during school time.
And what did they do instead of working?
They spent mainly their time on academics and hanging out in the special ed classrooms.
What advice would you give young people with disabilities about working?
My advice would be that they should learn how to be in the community and working, and not to be afraid to fail.
What advice would you give employers about hiring young people with disabilities?
Don't be afraid to hire us and let us show you that we could work.
Is creating an incentive for employers to hire young people with disabilities a good idea, and why?
Yes, it is, because it gives the employer time to know to a person, and the cash incentive is also a way to get people into the door. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart and representatives of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. My name is Anna Keenan-Mudrick. I'm the Executive Director of Community Access Services. We're a provider organization that provides a wide range of supports to adults who experience developmental disabilities. I'm here to express, of course, my support of House Bill 2239. Really appreciate it and are rather excited about it. Representative Davis, thank you again. I know I thanked you once before for this legislation, particularly for you including and pointing out those who experience intellectual and developmental disability. Oftentimes, the population we support is sadly forgotten. And I do think that it's very critical that we start really spelling it out and ensuring that we're including, not excluding them. So truly appreciate that. But of course, beyond that, just the need that all youth experience, particularly those with any kind of challenge. This is a beautiful bill. So just a quick review of the many benefits of employment. And I know that Representative Davis did certainly speak to many of these himself, but just really emphasizing that having a job, of course, means that you have a fuller life. You're contributing fully as a citizen to your community. So, of course, the personal benefit that goes along with that for anyone, whether you experience a disability or a challenge or not, but also the contribution you then make to the employer by bringing, as Ross was talking about, your skills, your abilities, your energies to the table. And I think really, too, listening to Representative Whitsett talk about the need in agriculture is a great example. We have a lot of workforce demands that far exceed, I think, the workforce that we seem to have before us. So I think that this would also really show those who and get those who experience developmental disabilities and who are youth in general, we get them excited about the opportunity and show them, hey, you know, maybe there's a chance for me too. So I think that also just being able to bring additional employees or potential employees to the table that might otherwise think that they won't have a shot is another side benefit of this legislation. So I think it will bring new employees out into the workforce that are much needed. So there's a benefit that goes beyond just even being able to bring in and add diversity to your workforce. Of course, also another benefit of being able to contribute to your community fully is being able to decrease your dependence on public benefits. This was also mentioned by Representative Davis, but it's very real and significant, and also the contributions that each employee would then make as a taxpayer, which brings in revenues as well. Some of the barriers that are out there that this bill would help mitigate. There is an 86% unemployment rate right now for those who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities. That is awfully shocking, and it shocks me, and I've been in this field for 22 years. It still shocks me. I think it probably would surprise many who aren't aware of that. So that is a huge barrier in and of itself to overcome. So this would be, you know, something that would help us work toward a remedy that is very needed there. Then there are the misperception, of course, the misperceptions that go along with just being a youth. Some of it might be a little bit credited, but some of it might be understandable given inexperience that any youth brings to the table, right? But as it is, being a youth, a young person, there are certainly a lot of things that we think about that go along with that that aren't always very positive. And then when you couple that with being an individual, a youth who also experiences a developmental disability, because of many misperceptions that are out there around ability to work at full productivity, the value, the misperceptions around lack of value that someone with a disability brings. Unfortunately, we have quite a tradition of exclusion in our society as a country. That doesn't just exist here in Oregon, obviously. So many who we support have not had the opportunity to really be a part of and fully a part of our community, including our workplaces. They haven't had a chance to come in and really show what they've got and how much value they bring to every part of our society, including the workforce. So this is really a critical tool. Again, you know, as many of us have said or have heard, a tool that we have in our tool bag as we're going around to employers saying, here is someone we represent who experiences a lot of talents, quite frankly, right? Brings a lot of talent to the table. Here is what they will bring to your workplace. But also, here's, you know, a financial incentive as well. It just helps them feel a little bit better about taking what they see is a risk. So, and with, again, with coming along with being a youth who probably still needs to do some resume building, that there is some risk there, certainly. So it really helps them feel better about that, which is awfully critical. There is also, I want to make sure to mention as well, that there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes, as Erica was talking about, with ODDS, the Department of Developmental Disability Services, that has really been working in collaboration with stakeholders, with providers, with advocates around responding to the governor's executive order. And I really feel that this particular piece of legislation really helps very much support the executive order that is focused on the integrated work opportunities for adults with developmental disabilities. It's a huge focus, a huge amount of energy and effort is needed there, particularly around those who are youth being identified as one of their priority populations, and then also those who are in sheltered employment. So that goes beyond what this specifically speaks to, but it speaks specifically to the youth, and which, again, really supports the governor's executive order, and we all want to do that and move forward with evolving our service system and our society more toward inclusive, fully toward and into inclusive employment. So this is very exciting in that it supports that as well. All right, I think that summarizes my points, unless anyone has any questions. So thank you again.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, thank you all for being here and for testifying. And I just wanted to kind of give you, anyone who wants to answer, and the opportunity to talk about this particular proposal and how this fits in and maybe complements and is better than or different from other programs that support these youth and other employment opportunities for these youth. Like, how do you see this as being more of an advantage or different from other programs that already that exist?
Erica may know of more as well with her background as a VR counselor, but I know I'm an executive director now, but years ago when I was doing job development myself, we had the work opportunity tax credit. That was helpful, but it just really gets you about a couple thousand dollars in savings. So this to me is more substantial, more significant, which provides even more incentive. The other incentives that we bring to the table typically for individuals who we support who experience developmental disabilities are more around the supports that we can provide in job coaching and consultation. Sometimes we go in and we assess a work environment, identify needs, and create positions that we say will be beneficial to the employer and, of course, to the employee. But this specifically provides them with a tax savings that goes well beyond what, and not to dismiss work opportunity tax credit. I don't want to put it down, but it's definitely of fairly small impact when you compare it to this more powerful tax credit.
Thank you.
Erica?
Representative Smith Warner. A lot of the programs that exist now are, they don't target the employer. They have us get a youth ready and prepare them, and the missing piece is always the employer and the decision to hire. So like I said, there's a lot of work going in to a lot of these programs behind the scene, but the buck stops when a job developer approaches an employer and starts to talk about employment. So
this would help create a market for for these youths.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I just want to thank you all for being here and tell Ross what a great job he did. That was fabulous testimony. Thank you very much.
Yes. And, let me add my thanks as well. Thank you very much for your testimony today. We very much appreciate it. David Roth, Steve Robinson, anyone else want to be heard today on this bill? Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, and other members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to discuss this bill. I'm in kind of an ironic position. Ordinarily, Tax Fairness Oregon objects to the use of tax credits, but that are not carefully crafted. Fortunately here, there's a good deal of care that's gone into this. It's got a very clear targeted population. It's got a sunset to it. And the per employee expenditure, the 25% incentive seems to be reasonable as far as a typical range of investment in this kind of program. But they're granting the value of those details, I'm concerned in a way that the proponents are underselling this. And they're underselling it well. We heard it in Representative Davis's concern about whittling away the eligibility so as to bring the costs in credits per year down to, say, $2 million. Now, we've also been told this is a beautiful program, and I concur. It has a great deal of appeal to it and a very sensible objective. In fact, it strikes me that rather than, if it's as good as it could be, if we want it to be as good as it could be, then I don't think we should be whittling away at the free lunch category. It sounds then as though the many people who've been victimized by discrimination based on race, on language, and class and the like are perhaps more likely to be excluded than the label itself, than the labels attached to the bill would imply. But what that would amount to is either to either have a much larger tax expenditure or to actually put dedicated funds into the state budget that would address number one this potential need for those wage incentives on the one hand, but also to deal with something that has only been touched on by the other witnesses, and that is the problem: how do you really bring young people of the most disadvantaged type, with the least self-confidence and the least worldliness, into a positive connection with a skeptical employer who might actually have opportunities available, unless there is a good deal of intervention on the part either of school staff or probation staff or OYA staff, and so on. Now, the representatives that just made their presentation now in favor represent the disability classification, and where there is a long history of well-established nonprofit programs for assistance in finding employment and housing and the like. But for this to really fulfill what it promises, which is to create, to spend money that could be put into schooling on another kind of schooling, which is employment during adolescence, it would require a lot of intervention by school counselors, by school promoters, by job promoters and the like. And that, it seems to me, needs to be done with restricted funds in the state budget as a supplement to this tax credit. With that, you have a chance of a real success. And I recommend one final point, that this is such a challenge and such an important challenge and a challenging project that it would behoove the committee, I think, to have an annual review of its success. So as you can see, I'm not arguing that this is an unwise use of funds. I'm only suggesting that it will not bear the fruit you hope for unless more is invested in it than so far has been discussed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Robinson with Decision Metrics, although a better term for me today might be the Grinch. I'd like to give you a kind of a different perspective from what you've heard. This hiring tax credit program is typical of many ideas that come before you for consideration. It responds to a real problem and is undoubtedly a sincere attempt to address that problem in a cost-efficient fashion through a tax credit. And I want to give terrific kudos to Representative Davis for advocating for this population and working so hard to come up with a solution that is appealing in many ways. I certainly don't argue with the proposition that at-risk or disadvantaged youths should get a leg up in the job market. Unfortunately, as popular as these work opportunity tax credit programs have been nationwide, Representative Davis cited quite a few of them, the research that's been done does not indicate that they are effective in promoting the hiring of these youth or an efficient use of scarce government funds. As Mr. Roth indicated, the general fund program would be a much more effective approach to the problem. Generally, tax credits to incentivize hiring of various classes of applicants, such as long-term unemployed or veterans or others, while well-intentioned, just don't work often enough to justify the cost. The tax credit is the wrong tool to use for this problem. A study from a California research group found that around 90% of the hiring tax credits claimed were simply a windfall for the employers because they would have taken place anyway. This makes sense when you consider that employers are, and under our capitalist system should be, mainly motivated by profit. They will expand their workforces only when they need more people to do the additional work required to provide the goods and services they believe they can sell their customers. In other words, their hiring decisions are driven almost totally by the market, not by tax incentives. I found an evaluation of the Federal Work Opportunity Tax Credit Program that Representative Davis mentioned, which is similar to the proposal before you today that was published by the Congressional Research Service, or CRS, in 2011, and it's on OLIS, and you can find the evaluation portion there. I will just point out a few salient points from that evaluation. CRS cited a General Accounting Office study from 2001 in California and Texas. A quote from GAO reads, "The sample data suggests that employers do not view the practices as cost-effective and therefore presumably would not engage in them much, if at all." They also cited the Department of Labor study thus, "The tax credits play little or no role in the employer's recruitment policies, suggesting that employers would have had hired members of the target groups even if the programs were not available." Finally, from the Upjohn Institute, "Contrary to legislative intent, only one firm reported that prospective employees' eligibility for the tax credits might affect their hiring decisions." My message to you, as you do your due diligence on this and other tax credits before you, is to ask the tough questions. What exactly is the purpose of the proposal? Can we measure the outcomes accurately? In other words, to deal with the but-for question. Are the benefits that we're trying to achieve, is this the only way to get those benefits, or are we actually making effective use of the money to get those benefits? And what does existing research tell us about whether the program is likely to be effective? The research that I have found indicates that it's not an effective tool. If Representative Davis and other proponents think that it is, I would hope that they could find research that would indicate that. So I would ask you to make sure these questions have been addressed before moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We very much appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2239 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2566. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2566 would provide that businesses and individuals who are operating or working in the state as in helping the state deal with a disaster or an emergency would not become subject to the corporate or personal income taxes. For the corporations, it's basically that you have an out-of-state business that comes in to help under such circumstances. Without this provision, they could be considered doing business in the state and become subject to the corporate tax. And for individuals who live outside of the state and earn income in the state, they would be subject to the personal income tax as a non-resident. This bill would prevent both of those cases.
Wonderful. Representative, you've been sitting back there quietly this whole meeting, and thank you for sticking around.
I'm not so quiet now, though.
Oh, good.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm District Representative 12, which is Springfield, and I'm here really to just encourage your fair consideration of this bill. This is a bill that we worked on quite extensively in the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, and actually worked on some amendments, because once we'd heard the testimony, we felt so strongly about the long-term applicability of the bill and wanted to make sure, from our perspective, we got it in a shape that needed for consideration. I want to emphasize what we would hope is we'd never have to use the provisions of these bills, because we're only talking about a disaster or a large emergency, so something that the President of the United States declares as an emergency or disaster, or the governor of the state of Oregon. That's under the only conditions under which any of the provisions of this measure would be used. Secondly, it only applies to what we call critical infrastructure, and that's defined in the bill. As we talked about that and how if we were to have one of those disasters, the need to get certain services back up quickly for other recovery, frankly, is what's most important. In many cases, you need to rely on people outside of our state technology and that to come in and to help us to recover from that particular thing. So that's what this is pointed at. One of the things that we did feel strong about in the bill was having some accountability for knowing who's in the state, though, during those times, so that if something were to occur, the questions that they could be addressed. And so one of the provisions of this bill is that DAS, so once the company first has to be invited in, so for somebody to come in and work under these conditions, a business that's registered to do business in the state of Oregon is the one that has to invite them in. Then that business would be responsible within 30 days of providing the information, the contact information, and who's here, under what conditions, to DAS. Then DAS would have that information. You know, in theory, in most cases, information would never be required to use it for any reasons. But if somebody did, if some other department asked her that, the information would be available, and DAS would make that information available to those persons. These people would be allowed to be in the state for the length of the disaster, or 60 days, or until after the governor that is declared that the emergency at that particular point is over, and then they would have to leave. But during that time they would be here, they wouldn't have to register, the businesses would not have to register individually with the states, nor would the employees be subject to state income taxes. So the key here is to be able to get in, to prepare, repair the critical infrastructure so that this state can get on with its business of trying to respond to it, and then leave so that the long-term repairs can be done. But I would really encourage your consideration of this motion.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Lively? Representative Vega-Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. This is really interesting. And I actually have a question. I think it's probably more for staff, though.
Please, yeah.
I know that since this is coming to revenue, it probably got a fiscal light or a revenue light when it was coming over here. This seems to me like the revenue impact would be very indeterminate because it's an emergency situation where we never know if it's mm-hmm. going to happen or not. I mean, is there any, I mean, can you imagine there being any revenue impact to this?
Co-Chair Vega-Peterson, the revenue impact statement would probably be an indeterminate. I think I indicated that on the light. Mm-hmm. Because it would involve predicting and forecasting such natural disasters and the magnitude of such natural disasters.
Could you try that?
Did you? Yeah.
That tends to be a little bit beyond our scope.
Let us know, and we'll be out of state that day.
So the bottom line is, I have difficulty seeing it not being an indeterminate.
Okay. Anything else for the representative? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And you're sorry. Welcome to stay or go about your business.
I'll go back.
Thank
I appreciate you. The invitation, but I'll go
Thank
back.
You. Thank you. All right. I have four people signed up to testify. You can come up in whatever order you want. John Powell, George Granger, Barb Young, and Mike Dewey. Or you can all come at once. I suppose we can find another chair. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today other than the four? So we'll add another panel. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing AT&T. Alongside me is George Granger, president of AT&T in Oregon. AT&T brought forth House Bill 2566, and I'll just briefly give you a short background on the bill. I think Representative Lively explained it exactly what the bill seeks to do. First of all, the genesis of the bill comes out of 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and Superstorm Sandy. These issues were studied by the NCSL, and an effort was made by a NCSL subcommittee to put forth a model language that could help critical infrastructure companies move immediately upon when a major disaster occurs. And so House Bill 2566 is, for the most part, other than the amendments Representative Lively mentioned, the same as the NCSL Model Act, which is now passed in 17 states since 2012, and five states are considering this year. The bill would not be as we see it, any kind of financial boom or incentive for AT&T, the company. However, it would be an incentive for AT&T's out-of-state employees who, when a disaster strikes, volunteer to leave their home state to go serve in a disaster state. The reasons for that being that even if they are here for a very limited period of time, they will have to file a W-2 in not just their home state, but in any disaster state in which they go visit. They are, in just about all cases, do not make enough money in that short period of time to actually owe taxes, but they still have to file a tax return, hire accounting services in multiple states in order to get their credit back. I'll pass it over to George Granger with AT&T, who can further illustrate how helpful this bill would be to us in a disaster.
Thank you, John. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for your consideration of this bill today, and I also appreciate Representative Lively being with us today. We did spend a great deal of time with Representative Lively and his committee. They were terrifically helpful in helping us work our way through the bill to find a policy position that really would better serve the people of Oregon in case of a disaster. So I wanted to thank Representative Lively and his committee for that good work. I think that Representative Lively and John did a terrific job describing the purpose of the bill. Really, what this is intended to do is to make it easier for volunteer employees from AT&T, but from any company that has critical infrastructure and relies on their employees who are well-trained experts in particular technology to come into that state and quickly restore your critical infrastructure. It's important, obviously, for public safety. It's important for the economic recovery of the state. And from a revenue perspective, I think the perspective around the country has been that the sooner you get back up on your feet, the sooner your economy begins to hum again, and that will be good for revenue here in the state of Oregon. So I hope that you will, like Representative Lively's committee, feel comfortable in supporting this legislation and recommending it to the floor. Thank you.
Members of the committee, Chair Barnhart, for the record, my name is Barb Young, and I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink. And I think my testimony in Representative Lively's committee was just ditto, so I'll wrap it up with that. CenturyLink will be in exactly the same position as AT&T. In the event of a disaster in Oregon, we will need to bring in both crews and equipment from out of state, and this just streamlines that process for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so in these emergency situations, do you anticipate when you go to your teams of folks and tell them you're going to send them to Oregon a scream of, oh, my God, no, 10% income tax, we're not going? Is that what's driving this bill?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. I think it's more of the hurdles in terms of a company being uncertain of just exactly what boxes they need to check before an employee goes to a state, which could delay it by days, weeks. We don't know. For example, AT&T would bring in what are called cows and colts, sell on wheels, sell on tractor trailer. And these are large pieces of equipment that may or may not need to get some kind of special permit under normal operating procedure to move into the state. With this bill, we just know we can bring them right in. Number two, with an out-of-state employee, it may be necessary, for example, the employee may be located in Ohio and work for AT&T Ohio, AT&T's affiliate incorporated in Ohio. It may be necessary to transfer that employee for a temporary basis into employment with AT&T Oregon in order to start withholding on the income tax, which could delay things. So those are the kinds of circumstances.
So with basketball players or pro players, they pay the tax in whatever state they may go into. Mm-hmm. If the folks that we're talking about's job is emergency stuff, why are they different than pro basketball players?
Because that isn't actually their job. They have a daytime job in their home state. They're working in that home state providing the same service that, say, Oregon employees would provide. When an emergency strikes and we need additional forces to come in and quickly restore that critical infrastructure, we will then call out to our trained volunteer force and invite them to come to Oregon and say, help us restore the economy in Oregon, help us restore public safety in Oregon. So they leave the job that they do every day in their home state, and they travel here to Oregon to perform just that specific function in the case of that well-defined emergency for the length of time that it's been declared. One thing that we didn't say, and we should certainly point out, is that the employees will pay all transaction taxes that you would expect them to pay, hotel, rental cars, whatever other kinds of taxes they would encounter. They would be responsible for paying those taxes. This is just a streamlining of some of the procedures that delay us from getting them into the state.
So when you say volunteer, you mean they still get paid. They're not working for nothing.
Right.
They get paid, and they must have been – they don't come here because they don't want to, because they volunteer.
So otherwise you wouldn't call them volunteers. So they're coming here for some reason.
Yes.
Whether you pay them more to do that, or do you pay them more
no.
to come here? So they decide they want to go to Oregon for whatever reason.
Well, because they have a commitment to public safety. They have a commitment to restoring the critical infrastructure across the country. And as John has mentioned, they've done this in Hurricane Sandy situations. They've done this in Katrina. They've done this in 9/11. These are employees who are trained for responding to emergencies over and above their own ability to do their jobs every day. So really, in a sense, I mean, just like any other community volunteer who has the community interest at heart, that is really what motivates these employees to come in and do that. And the purpose of this bill is to make it easier for them, not to put any burdens in front of them. If, for example, having multiple W-2s come their way, having to work with tax preparers to file taxes in different states and then get a refund. So we're really just trying, and this isn't just true for AT&T, any company who's restoring this critical infrastructure would be facing the same kind of situation. We're just trying to make it easy for that to happen so that we can move employees in more quickly. And your question about the 10%, oh no, let's just say that were the reaction, and I'm sure it would not be. But what we would not want to have happen is for that to be a burden on anybody. So they would say, how quickly can I get to Oregon? Because my objective is to get there as quickly as we can.
Yeah, please, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We may be assuming everyone is the same as AT&T. That would probably be a mistake. I'm guessing every company has a little different approach to this. And if people are trained up for this emergency service, then indeed this is done in anticipation of just such a contingency as they're coming to this state. And so I'm thinking that the company also has a really good reason to try to get this infrastructure back up into speed, because that's how AT&T makes money. So there's a really good reason to come into these states and get all this stuff back to work. So I'm having a hard time, I guess, with the concept of everybody volunteering to come in, because to me it's more of a business thing and less of a emergency thing. Now, I haven't been through Katrina, and hope not to have to suffer through that. I think I may just be struggling with the label that we're putting on these things. I may agree with you completely in what you're suggesting, but I'm not sure I agree with the labels being put on it. That's why my questions.
Well, again, I think, first of all, let's think of, I can only respond to the AT&T situation, and maybe Barbara would have a different perspective on their company, but essentially what happens is we have employees who have, as I mentioned earlier, they have a daytime job. And they, when an emergency strikes, arguably, they can just stay where they are and do their daytime job. If I'm sitting in California and there's a crisis in Oregon, I have a job to do. I have a life in California, so I stay there. These are people who have a desire, as I say, to serve the community, and they understand the importance of this critical infrastructure, which is going to assist public safety, which is hopefully going to help people get the health results that they need, which is going to get your economy moving again more quickly. And they say they're volunteering their time to leave their job, they're leaving their homes, they're leaving their families for whatever time they're able to spare during this period of an emergency to perform work which they're uniquely qualified to perform over and above the force that we have in the state. And the purpose of that is to quickly restore this critical infrastructure so that Oregon or any state where this disaster has taken place can quickly come up to speed, where lives can be saved and where the economy can then begin to work again. So what would a company do if the volunteers weren't there, if that workforce wasn't there? You would deal with that infrastructure as quickly as you could with the workforce on the ground, but if you could bring other workers in with tremendous skills and a desire to serve, and you could make that burden lighter for them, it seems to me you'd want to do that.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking there's room for disagreement in the labels, and there's also room for disagreement about the motivations. But I think I've exhausted that with my questions. I'm interested in the concept.
Thank you. Representative Leininger, please.
You know, I saw the time, and I know Mr. Dewey and another gentleman are hoping
to. Of course, this is one of those days that we're running long.
Yes.
Today and Thursday.
Pass.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, George and John. Thank you all for your testimony very much. We've been talking a little bit about taxes, but it seems to me that the critical issue here is really in the professional context and in the highly regulated context, where we deal with a situation where there's a business and, you know, let's not call it AT&T, let's call it some sort of professional services firm from another state that all of a sudden says, oh, my gosh, half of Oregon has now been dumped into the sea by the big quake. We got to get folks over there. But as we read our licensing laws, we can't, in good conscience, as an employer, send our professionally licensed employees into Oregon without going through licensing with the bar, although you never want to send attorneys. I just go there as an attorney right away. But think of any of the other hundreds of licensing agencies that we have as a
electricians.
State. There you go. I'm looking for electricians, critical services, infrastructure. I mean, it seems to me that that's really the urgency here. I mean,
right.
You know, the taxes piece, I understand that discussion. I think it's important. But the more immediate and, I think, pertinent element of consideration is in the professional, licensed, and highly regulated context. Is that correct? Question mark.
I would say both are important, if you're asking me, Representative
yeah.
Davis, because it seems to me, again, going back to the notion of you want to be able to bring in qualified employees to quickly restore this critical infrastructure and whatever the necessary property would be or technology would be to help restore that critical infrastructure as quickly as possible for the reasons we've discussed. But at the same time, and recognizing the comments from Representative Vince earlier, was these are employees who would otherwise be located elsewhere and looking again for a way to make sure that you can ease their path into the state, allow them to serve and do the work that they need to do, and then return back to their home state without further complications from a taxing perspective. So I think both work together. I think both are critical to ensuring that Oregon would get back up on its feet. And as Representative Lively said, I certainly hope we never have to see this put into play.
Thank you, Representative. What's it?
This is probably a question for not this panel, but didn't we pass a bill last session that allowed the governor, in the event of a declared natural disaster in the state, to do whatever was necessary to implement whatever means were necessary to deal with the natural disaster at hand? I thought we had a bill like that either last session or the session before.
Well, we did pass a constitutional amendment mm-hmm. that gave the governor authority to do a bunch of things mm-hmm. in a natural disaster.
Right.
It also allowed the legislature to meet at places other than the city of Salem and with less than a quorum in order to conduct business.
Right.
And so, you know, but we're talking about something that's going to take a fair amount of time to recover from if we're dealing with that particular rule.
Yeah. I was just wondering if this bill would be covered under that.
Some of it
okay.
might be, right. I had some questions as well, and these are a bit more technical. On page 2, there's a reference to out-of-state business, and part of it is it's requested by a registered business or by a state or local government entity for the purpose of performing disaster emergency-related work in the state. I have no problem with any of that, but I'm wondering whether you've taken into account issues like local electric co-ops, private water systems that aren't incorporated and maybe not even be defined as businesses in Oregon, and other weird entities that Oregon has that staff thinks may not be either businesses or state or local government entities. Would you object to some kind of an amendment that would include them and the people who are allowed to invite?
I don't think so. I think that I don't think so. No,
I'm thinking about things like the electric co-ops. We have a bunch of electric co-ops in my neighborhood, for example, who would have the same kind of problems that CenturyLink would have dealing with the telephone lines with their power lines.
I think, Chair Barnhart, I think the purpose of the bill, which is just to restore that critical infrastructure, and so if that would enhance the ability to restore the critical infrastructure.
Right. And then the other question I had to do with licenses, and I appreciate Representative Davis raising this issue. It doesn't appear, and I may have missed it, that that the license waiver that we have in this bill is only for people who already have a license at home. Is that in here somewhere?
I think it is.
Okay. Well, we'll continue looking for it. But I think it needs to be, don't you? You're not going to bring somebody in to work on your systems that isn't qualified to work on the systems.
Right. And from an AT&T perspective, the people that we would bring in would be people who in their home states are qualified to work on that particular element of the network, yes.
Yeah, and if you had to bring in linesmen from Louisiana, you'd bring in people who already do that work regularly.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, I think out-of-state businesses is a little bit confusing in that, you know, it's going to be an affiliate of CenturyLink. So, for example...
Well, for you it will be.
Yes.
But not for the electric co-op or the private water system.
Could be contractors.
They'll be hiring contractors
because
they don't have any out-of-state affiliates.
And I wouldn't say we would never bring in contractors. It depends on the scope of the disaster, right? I mean, at some point we may run out of people.
Well, the subduction quake could put the whole state in jeopardy west of the mountains.
Absolutely. Hmm. But for us, typically where we're going to start is our affiliate companies. So it's, you know, United Telephone of, you know, Missouri doing business as CenturyLink, if you will.
Right.
So that's kind of our scope of when you think of out-of-state businesses that we would be calling upon as far as a resource.
How long do these kind of emergencies last? I mean, the reason I ask that question is because the time limit during which this is in effect is until the emergency is over, declared to be over, I guess. How long do they last? You have experience in with the fall of the World Trade Center and probably with some big storms. Verizon had a huge center directly below the World Trade Center when it collapsed. I suspect AT&T had some facilities that also went down there and in other places. How long do these things last? During which we can expect this to last, and do you really need an exemption that lasts the entire period of time, or could we set a different number there somehow?
Well, I think that, I don't know, to be honest with you, Chair Barnhart, if there's an average length that the governors or presidents have declared emergencies, that would seem to me that would just depend on the severity of the emergency.
Okay.
I would think that you would probably want to ensure that the employees, whoever comes in to do this work, was covered for the entire period that the disaster was declared. But you're exactly right. It's a wide scope of things, from something as tragic as Katrina to the situation with 9/11 or Storm Sandy, and then also wildfires or anything that might fall into the governor or the president's lap and say that this is something critical to the state of Oregon to be restored. So it seems to me, for this time, for at least this purpose, we would want to make sure the employees knew that during the whole time they were there, so there wouldn't be a sense I've got to get out of here for some other reason.
Of course, you don't keep anybody past the time you need them,
right.
Even if the disaster is still not been declared to be over.
Exactly. Once their work is done, and we do not foresee further work for them, then we send them home because they would like to be back into the normal. You know, back at home doing their regular work.
And of course, your company wants them.
We'd like to have them back doing their other work.
Thank you so much. So now that I understand that we're going until 3, I will take up a couple minutes of Mr. Dewey's time.
Well, actually, I have until 3:30.
Oh,
and on Thursday, we have an even longer agenda, so be prepared.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to note, though, that I think this is a good idea. I mean, I thought I heard you say that the genesis for this is that the National League of State Legislators,
mm-hmm.
right, and CSL, has recommended it. It's kind of like a model,
it is.
You know, ordinance that lawyers would adopt state by state because it was recommended as good practice. And, you know, I think after the various events that we've seen and prompt responses that emergency infrastructure companies have been able to make that have helped communities get back on their feet, it seems like a prudent sort of foundational piece to lay now when we're not all in a panic, so
right.
that in the, and you know, hopefully not event that we are ever in a crisis, you know, folks can come in and get in and help us and everyone can move on as quickly as possible. So I appreciate the thought that's gone into this, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Leninger. I would just say that John indicated earlier 17 states have passed the model legislation for just the exact reasons. Before there's a crisis, before we're scrambling like mad to try to do the work we need to do. Let's get the systems in place. And one last thing I would just say about that, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, we have a whole team of these folks who are across the country with equipment all over the country, and they do regular exercises to sort of deal with potential disasters so that when something happens, we've sort of experienced it, whether we have actually experienced it or we've trained for it. And we just had one of these disaster preparedness exercises in Portland last year. I sure wish it could have been this year, because I think it would have been terrific for members of the legislature to see what goes into restoring communications, because it's a highly complex proposition.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
We're going to hear from Mike Dewey and from Colonel Stuckey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Mike Dewey, on behalf of the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, members such as Comcast, Charter, Wave, Cable One, they also operate in adjacent states. And I would say that I've been to another number of national meetings where we've had these conversations about what are the model laws that we ought to have, and this is one that's been discussed. And these companies have in place plans already to address how do you deal with something like a Sandy, Katrina, and other catastrophes, and it's kind of like lessons learned. We're not thinking about the tax equation here. What we're talking about is, are there any impediments for a business to get into a state, and what are they? And we think if you're passing this legislation, what this is these folks can come to Oregon as quickly as possible. And George was right. People volunteer, and they are on a list, and obviously if they can't come, they can't come. And I would say in terms of the affiliate business and the like, for the PUDs, which are local, the thinking is they don't have any employees outside of the state. They're in a discrete district. Now, whether or not you want to move that for contractors, and that would be fine, but that was the thinking behind the Model Act. So we applaud Representative Lively to work on this and AT&T to bring this forward, and we hope we can move this at some point. Thank you very much, and be happy to answer any questions if there are.
Thank you.
Questions.
Let's hear from the Colonel, and then I may have a couple for you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As of January of this year, previous to that, I was the Director for the Office of Emergency Management, and I believe that anything that expedites and facilitates the response and the recovery, and we've talked recovery at length in this discussion, but I would also like to encourage you to consider the response component to this. And anything, any disaster that we have also includes communications, and I appreciate AT&T's consideration and movement of this bill. The first thing that we need when we get on the ground is communications. It doesn't matter what effects we have or how bad it is. We need to be able to talk to people. Yes, sir. And that's very, very important. In fact, those cows and where those cows are at in this state is also very important and critical to us. And so we just appreciate your consideration of this, and we applaud your desire to listen to this and make certain that the due course is done for House Bill 2566. And with that, I conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much. I was under the impression that out-of-state business would include a contractor who was brought in at the request of a registered business under the definition of this. Did I misread that somehow?
Representative Barnhart, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I was just thinking of it from a discrete cable company that operates in a number of states and has a plan in place, but it does seem to make sense.
Right.
If it's not there to add that.
We would appreciate that to
but
be
what
there
it says
also.
Is an out-of-state business means a foreign business entity that, except for disaster or emergency-related work, transacts no business in this state. And the services of which are requested by a registered business, that means you some other registered business, or by the state local government entity for purposes of performing disaster or emergency-related work in the state. That doesn't seem to me to be limited to somebody that's affiliated with your company. Could be somebody you contract with for emergency services,
I think. I agree with that.
Yeah.
The reading.
Right.
in that critical infrastructure, particularly the water and sewer systems, making certain, you know, we had a pretty significant issue with the cryptosporidium action in Baker City a couple of years ago. And Baker also sits on a couple of faults across this in their valley.
It certainly does.
And so,
well, you can see I'm losing my committee.
Yeah. So
they're off to 3 o'clock appointments. I will say that I'm going to explore a little bit this idea of amending the clause on out-of-state business. The clause on out-of-state business, which is limited to requests by registered businesses or by state of local or local governments, to see if we need to expand that to include somebody else. Now, let me ask the current. This may be a question for you. You are, or your organization is a state government entity, isn't it?
Sir.
So if you got a request from an electric co-op, we need help, we'd like to hire XYZ Corporation from Boise, Idaho, to come in and help, do you think that you would have the authority under this bill to be the invitor for that thing that's not a registered business or a state or local government entity?
That's a very good question, Chair Barnhart.
Can we look into that?
We can.
Because if you are, then I don't need an amendment to the bill. If you're not, then I have to figure out how to do
that. Our construct, quite frankly, is basically to bring all state agencies in and to help facilitate this. And to be frank, ESF-7, which is the resource component on the response plan,
right,
is done by the Administrative Services, by DAS.
They're a state entity.
And they are. And so we look to them. The DOD and Department of Defense, the 6th Fleet could be out there across on the Pacific.
Well, sure.
But in the end, it's still going to be private sector that recovers this state. It's not going to be the military or anyone else. And so they may help with response, but sooner or later, they're moving on. And anything that helps facilitate and enhance that, it would be advantageous.
I think I may have answered my own question,
sure.
and that's fine. Sure. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill, 2566. And members of the committee, those who are left, we are adjourned.
Good choice, Mr. Chair.